then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's July the 25th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, we've got Gretchen and Andy and Olivia this week, as well as my own ranting and raving. But for some weeks now, I've been letting the emails pile up, and I've been promising to respond to people, and I never do, or else I'll start out intending to respond to 3 or 4 emails, and I only respond to one because I wander off on a Grandpa Simpson-like tangent. So, this week, I'm going to do my best to give quick responses to as many of the emails I've got in my stack of stuff as I can. Stack of stuff. Damn, I'm listening to too much Rush Limbaugh. I'm starting to sound like him. Okay, first off, this one is from Tina in Asheville, North Carolina, and I get variations of this every week. Dear Harold, is it true that you are a Jew and a federal informant? Dear Tina, no, it is not true. It is true, however, that whoever told you that is an idiot. This next one is from Christian, also in North Carolina. Dear Harold, I am 17 and live in Eastern NC. Now, I've been an avid follower of the Northwest Front, news-wise, and I'm an avid white nationalist. Recently, I was invited to join the Klan, and I'm asking your advice. Being that I'm 17, I'm still a tad vain and want to keep my friends, but I also want to be more active, more out there in the world of white nationalism. My friends already know that I'm National Socialist, but they don't take it seriously and consider it passed-down racism that will wear off as I get older, so I'm thinking that if I make this step, I'll be ostracized. Now, I know this is exactly the BS you taunt and put down on Radio Free Northwest, and I don't expect you to be soft on me, but I do need the advice. Thank you, Christian. Dear Christian, first off, my advice to you is not to worry about anything going on down east and start preparing for your homecoming to the Northwest. But you're not going to take that advice. I know, because the overwhelming majority of the people listening to this show do not. Now, if you people were living here in the Pacific Northwest in communities with other white nationalists less than half an hour's drive away from your homes, then the overwhelming majority of these questions would be unnecessary. But then, if wishes were horses, then beggars would ride. Now, you didn't mention, Christian, which of the 1,412 little mini-clans you've been asked to join. Now, most of them have less than 50 members. Hell, most of them have less than a dozen. I don't want to generalize too much because I haven't lived in the South for many years, but from what I gather, it's the same as it was back in my day, just more so. There are no more big clans like the UKA of the 1950s and 60s or David Duke and Bill Wilkinson's clan of the 1970s, or even that poor slob J.W. Ferens from the 1980s whom Morris Dees sent fleeing, screaming, and sobbing into the night. Okay, Christian, you have asked my advice, which we both know that you fully intend to ignore, but don't sweat it, everybody ignores what I say. If they didn't, we wouldn't be in this mess. It's who we are. Now, for the record, my advice is to quit fooling around with whatever little bunch of clowns you're hooked up with, all 7 or 8 of them. They are never going to do anything. If they do, they don't have the intelligence not to get caught, and so you might end up down there on East Morgan Street in Raleigh, if you get my drift. You need to concentrate on graduating from high school, if you haven't already. You need to get whatever piece of paper you can get from the place, and then get your ass out here to the Pacific Northwest by hook or crook and prepare to commit yourself to the new nation that we are going to build as a homeland for all white people. Now, that's what you should be doing, but most likely you won't. You're young, and you figure you've got about 25 years of fucking around and putting strange poisonous chemicals in your body and marrying women who turn out to be bitches and take everything you've got and kick you into the gutter before they move on. 25 years in which you will waste your 20s and 30s wallowing in money and filth in the American slop trough before you wake up at age 42 or so, broke, unemployed, and now unemployable because of your race, your age, and your gender, and you will find that America has thrown you away, and you're still sitting down there in the piney woods in eastern North Carolina wondering what the hell happened. Then is when you're going to come running to the party, weeping and crying that you've been hard done by, and America has butt-fucked you, and please, please, Mr. Northwest, do something about it. Kiss it better. And then, maybe then, you'll be ready to actually do what you should have done 25 years before. Now, I don't know what kind of shape you're going to be in your mid-40s, Christian. It could well be that you will be in a position to be a lot of good to us then. Maybe more than when you were 17. I don't know. But frankly, given the choice, Christian, we need you out here at age 17, not in your mid-40s, as a broken and disillusioned middle-aged man. Guys, let's just get something clear. I'm not angry or bitter here. I have had to come to terms with all this and accept the reality as it is. And again, I'm just saying, like it or not, this is who we are. I'm just stating the reality that we have to deal with, and we better find some way to deal with it and become effective. Now, in view of the virtual certainty that Christian is going to ignore what I tell him to do and go join some silly little half-baked self-proclaimed Klan group that couldn't even raise a full football team, and in view of the likelihood that he's going to walk down the street of his hometown wearing a cheap robe with no mask while all the niggers laugh at him, the robe will be made in China, and quite possibly he's going to get ID'd and put on the list of the usual suspects for the rest of his life in the FBI database up there in West Virginia. And he's going to do all this for no gain whatsoever. What I'm going to do for Christian, instead of babbling on here about why this is a bad idea, since everybody with two brain cells to rub together already knows why it's a bad idea, I'm going to let a man who was, in my humble opinion, the greatest Klansman of the 20th century tell you what the Klan should be like. Now, I refer to my old father in hate, the late Pastor Robert Miles. I'm going to read you an article that he wrote in the late 1980s, I believe it was, sometime around then, in his From the Mountain newsletter. It's called A Klansman's Guide to the Fifth Era. Now, just as an aside, I really hate sitting here and reading things to you guys, and I would give my eye teeth for an MP3 file of Bob himself reading or speaking these lines and ideas, but I haven't been able to find any sound footage of Bob at all anywhere on the internet, not so far anyway. Now, I know a lot must exist from the old days, probably on old Super 8mm or whatever, and I know that Bob made some Race and Reason tapes with Metzger, which I would love to get hold of in MP3 format. Sound only for the show. Now, please, guys, do not send me the raw video and ask me to find somebody who will strip the soundtrack for me. I really don't have time to piss around learning new software. Guys, I appreciate your increasing enthusiasm for Radio Free Northwest. No kidding, I do. But a little rule of thumb here. If it doesn't arrive in my email box in MP3 format only, not as a video or else as a link to some place where I can download MP3 only, not the whole video, then I can't use it for the show. Okay, dragging myself kicking and screaming back to Bob Miles and what he would say to this 17-year-old kid in North Carolina who's probably about to mess up his life by starting out on the wrong track. Christian, this is what a real Klansman has to say. As the Klan enters the fifth era of its existence, we as Klansmen must have a full understanding of the rules governing this period. To attempt to carry on the work of the Order by the old standards and methods of conduct is analogous to fighting a war today with the weapons of World War I. Although a cavalry charge is a grand and glorious thing to watch, or be a part of if you have the courage, it is, as the Poles found out in the beginning of World War II, an outdated method of fighting. Today's battles must be fought with today's weapons. No one in the Klan movement can doubt that we are now engaged in a great war, testing whether this people known as White Aryan Man shall survive, as this conflict is a battle for survival, it is by definition a no-holds-barred contest. Our enemy has at his disposal the very latest in technology, the financial resources of the government, total control of the mass communications media, and the minds of most of our own people whom the members of the Order fight to save. In a word, virtually unlimited resources. To win against such a foe requires the very best in ingenuity and intelligence that our race can produce. Anything less than excellence in strategy, planning, tactics, and skilled management of available resources is tantamount to aiding and abetting the enemy in the destruction of our race. Ignorance, like cancer, cannot be tolerated. It is the duty of every Klansman to know and understand the present conflict. In the first era of the Klan, lasting from 1865 to 1876, the Order was totally secret. For a member to reveal the identity of another member meant instant death at the hands of his former comrades. The men of the Klan knew and understood that if the government could locate them, they would be imprisoned or killed. So it shall be soon in the fifth era, in all respects. Though the government currently wages only a legal campaign in their courts against those who fight for race and nation, and by the way, bear in mind, this was written 35 years ago, before the Obama dictatorship just started locking people up and sending them to Guantanamo Bay and murdering them without cause. Anyway, getting back to Bob Miles's comments here. Even though the government currently wages only a legal campaign in their courts against those who fight for race and nation, this will soon change as the tyrants in Washington come to the realization that this will not stop America's freedom fighters. Mental wards for some, roadside ambushes for others. Either way, one less soldier of freedom. With this in mind, secrecy becomes the watchword of the Fifth Era. The country is moving irresistibly towards internal armed conflict between those who fight for their heritage and those who seek to destroy it. The enemy has managed to capture the government. So, for the third time in this nation's history, the government has become the enemy of the people. The first time this occurred, our nation was able to produce resolute, intelligent leaders who directed the American people in a war against the government. Death, violence, suffering, and sacrifice ruled supreme for 7 long years, but eventually the people won. The king was overthrown and the republic born. Many years later, during Reconstruction, a hate-filled and vindictive America violated its own terms of surrender given to a valiant but defeated foe who had sought independence. An attempt was made to enslave the people of the South at the hands of their own former slaves. Once again, the people were led by great leaders to fight the government, and where open combat failed, secret struggle was successful. So it shall be in the Fifth Era, for the Anglo-Saxon does not long bow down to the heavy hand of tyranny. When, in the still of the early morning hours of 1869, the pounding of hooves was heard across the valleys of Tennessee or the mountains of Georgia, it meant that the Klan was riding with a mission and purpose. Those who supported the government's tyranny dreaded the sound of those terrible horsemen who rode to execute the will of the folk upon the enemies of freedom. Openly, they prayed to their craven gods to let the hooves pass them by. The horsemen rode with a single-minded purpose. There would be a white man's government in this country, or no government. So it will be in the Fifth Era. The first era of the Order had among its ranks the very best in Southern manhood. Those who did not understand and live by the virtues of honor, duty, loyalty, and courage and discipline were not accepted into its ranks. Once accepted, if a man failed to follow these pathways to superiority, his punishment was commensurate to the transgression. For those engaged in the struggle for survival of civilization in 1865 could not afford to have other than the very best, nor can we of the Fifth Era. The precepts of the Order are for all who take the oath. None are exempted. They are the foundation stones upon which the Order rests, as well as the building blocks by which the individual Klansman forms his life. The pathway to the inner circle can be found by those who know, understand, and obey them. Number 1. This is a Christian organization, and none but Christians may join. Reverence for God and obedience to His commandments are the only true sources of wisdom and understanding. The foundations of America were laid by men who fear God and openly confess the Lord Jesus Christ. They were moral and lived a life shaped by their obedience to the laws of God. The history of the Founding Fathers and of our nation is the history of a racially pure family. The Klan seeks to preserve that history and family. We cannot hope to be successful if we are in violation of God's word. Therefore, we obey it as our understanding declares it unto us. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion hath light with darkness? It's from the second book of Corinthians, chapter 6, verse 14. As we light the fiery cross to dispel the darkness around us and bring light to the night, so must we dispel those who would bring darkness into our midst. Secondly, this order will strive forever to maintain the God-given supremacy of the white race, to preserve the blood purity, integrity, culture, and traditions of the Aryan people. Number three, the Klan concedes no authority to anyone whatsoever to govern this nation not arising out of the Constitution as intended by the founders of this nation. Pretenders to authority, usurpers, and would-be despots shall never peacefully rule us. To this we swear. Either the white man shall govern this land under the laws and the customs of our forefathers, or no government shall. Number four, in that we proclaim one God and no other, his law and no other, our racial nation or no nation. Number five, we concede to no individual group or entity whatsoever the right to destroy the life, liberty, sustenance, and racial well-being of our people. Individual rights are where the welfare of the folk begins. The order shall ever be the judge, jury, and hangman of those who violate the sacrosanct canons. Okay, Christian, that's the end of Bob's article there. Now, the people who are inviting you to join their little clan grouplet cannot measure up to Bob Miles's standards. No one can anymore. I can't. Don't waste your time on the clan, Christian. Find some way to come home. I know you're just 17, which actually means it should be a little easier for you than for older people who've accumulated all kinds of baggage. Christian, this is the right thing to do, and that's my duty station in all this, to tell you what is right. I do it to the best of my ability. Now, you're either going to do what I say and come home to the Northwest and become part of the solution rather than part of the problem, or you won't. Okay, first music break. This is from our British balladeer, Arland. Once again, I hate to rain on parades, but the mixing on this is a little heavy on the piano and the music and a little light on the vocals, which, as I've mentioned before, is a common problem with all of our music. It's just a really great thing that this music is being done at all. I had some trouble understanding the lyrics. Nonetheless, at least these songs are being written and sung. I think guys like Arland and our Kentucky balladeer Lawrence are jewels in our crown. Keep it up, guys. Don't worry, we'll get the electronic stuff sorted out later. Anyway, the song is called The Wanderer. Many
time to show me which way to follow, which way to follow.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andreas Donner here again. I recently met a new comrade in my neck of the woods who suggested the party try to offer something positive. Of course, we have been, but it's not exactly something most of you want to hear. I've even gone positive on RFN before, and this generated absolutely no response from the usual suspects who regularly complain we're somewhat negative. I suppose it's worth a shot, since whatever else we may or may not do to motivate you, simple restatements of truth make decent entertainment, if nothing else. Trying a thought experiment, it occurred to me lots of things can be looked at in a positive light. Toying with the principles of Northwest migration resulted in a slightly different and much more positive outlook on our exact racial situation, which I'm going to share with you today. White nationalists today live in a very exciting time, and we all ought to be very grateful for being alive at this moment in the history of our race. For decades, our efforts to halt and reverse white genocide have utterly failed for various reasons. Anti-white agendas have progressed to the point where even the United States of America is on the brink of falling flat on its face due to the strain on society which third world populations always produce. There is no hope for the lower half of the country, and the Eastern Seaboard and Midwest are not viable entities on their own for logistic and strategic reasons. And yes, this is all completely positive. We no longer have to play silly political games or act as if we're nothing but American herd animals. We never really were, and now we have the perfect opportunity to correctly express our nationalism. For quite some time, we've made vows and promises to ourselves and others about what we're going to do. This is the perfect time to help the Northwest Front form a fighting revolutionary party. We no longer have to tolerate Republican and Libertarian sellouts in American politics who only disappoint us after we hold our noses for them when it's time to head to the polls, and we no longer have to agree to compromises just to pretend we have a seat at the table. The political game wasn't something we were ever going to win, and if we're at all honest with ourselves, we will admit it and move on. Further, if we're of a right mind, we'll want to move on. Old-school movement tactics are no longer appropriate because they were intended for a goal which is now totally impossible. We're free of those responsibilities and we may now move on to better things. Genuine white nationalists, those who wish to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children, will gladly embrace this fact as it leads to their racial salvation. Zog will be dead someday, and this is itself reason for rejoicing. It's dying right now, and this is all the more reason to engage in proper, productive racial activity. As I said, this time in the history of our race presents us with a unique opportunity, and those of you who truly do desire the survival of your race will refuse further failures, primarily those failures which you yourself are guilty of. We are no longer bound to adopt plans which were futile from the start. Instead, our race has been given the Butler Plan, which acknowledges the Northwest imperative. We white nationalists of the early 21st century have the privilege of creating a new nation where only we may exercise political power for only our benefit. This is a blessing. Adopting this strategy allows us to finally stop pretending our failures in the past were somehow noble. Refusing to act in those old ways any longer is the first step towards actual success. There are no other plans precisely for this reason. Whatever you believe in, God, the gods, Providence, the Great Pumpkin, or even the Flying Spaghetti Monster if it makes you happy, has given us this one last chance simply to illustrate that the critical flaw of all other ideas has been, well, the lack of an idea. Think about how great that is. We actually have something we could do to halt white genocide on the North American continent and the whole world. Further, our racial enemy actually grows weaker since any strength they had was based on the quality and quantity of the white men they employed, as well as the strength of Zog's economic empire. Their real supply of strength and capability is rapidly failing, and the possibility of seizing state power in the Pacific Northwest is better and better every day. This is practically serendipitous because the Pacific Northwest is the last location on this continent where a white-only nation could exist in the face of outside threats and still prosper on its own resources. The one thing we have going for us is exactly what we need right now. That shouldn't depress you at all. If the one plan we have is the right one for right now, then the only sane reaction is its zealous implementation. I realize this sort of positivity might not be convincing to those of you stuck in truly negative ruts, as opposed to the negativity the party is accused of, so let me provide an actual example out of my own life and discovery of the Northwest Front. In other Radio Free Northwest episodes, I've gone into detail about finding the party's message at exactly the right time in my own racial development. Prior to finding the party, I had realized the white man's real situation in the world. I come from a very upper-middle-class background, and I still largely exist in that world today. As an aside, don't let anyone tell you that can't be the case for you as well. The idea that you're going to implode your life for having racial views is actually very false for a couple of different reasons. Firstly, I'm accomplishing the opposite right now. Secondly, the world isn't what you think it is. If you're hearing my voice right now, you know that to be true. My point is a bit more profound than this simple realization, though. Having taken honest assessment of the true racial reality we face today, our lives are largely what they are because we live in a world created by white people despite what the Jews have been able to do to us. But this won't always be the case. As the Jew progresses, this world we live in will more and more rapidly resemble something where normal white men can't make their own progress as they could in years past. Those of us today are living in the time where we can no longer maintain ourselves and our families in the way we were brought up. This is actually good news for those willing to do something about it. If you can't do something, why bother trying? I realized I no longer had to run the rat race to keep myself up because such a thing wouldn't be possible no matter how I ignore reality. I'm periodically confronted by someone calling the Northwest Front organized white flight, and this cracks me up for a couple of reasons. Firstly, these people always live in white flight target locations, so they can't talk. Secondly, they insist our race fight a battle we can no longer win. Why fall on our swords when it won't even make a point? So they can have a few more nice years in their little towns all over the dying empire they cling to? Such a person has no place admonishing us while they are so self-centered. It's actually very exciting that we no longer need to maintain Zog's carcass since it can't be done. There's no reason to preserve this failed experiment, and there's every reason not to, chief among them our racial survival. Why try to preserve your way of life when there's nothing you can do about it? There's no gain in damning your children to the life you refuse for yourself when you dismiss the idea of creating the Northwest American Republic. No, really, refusing to come home and help the party is doing just that. Sure, we may have a hard task ahead of us, but the alternative is death. We no longer have anything to lose by not acting, since we're at the point in history where we will lose it all anyway, even the small towns which dot the white countryside. If we have nothing to lose and a plan to reverse this, then we have everything to gain. This is the most positive thing any one of us can realize, and as simply as the party can put it, refusing to aid us is the height of selfishness and folly. Those of you aware of the Northwest Front and the Butler Plan have one of the most exciting opportunities in all of history. You can trade in something of no real value, since you'll lose it anyway, for something of lasting value, the possibility of your race seeing tomorrow. What could be more positive than that? Hail victory, comrades!
Good afternoon, comrades. This is a topic you don't hear much about in this day and age, but I found the parallels and correlations very appropriate. I suppose in some way this is pretty basic for most of us, but it is one of those topics that is timeless in nature as long as we live in the type of world we live in today. By now, you're probably wondering just exactly what I intend to talk about, so I guess I shouldn't keep you waiting any longer. The topic is adultery and race. Once again, Christianity is used as a reference point, not only because it's one most of us are at least somewhat familiar with, but also because, as mentioned in another RFN, their arguments sometimes strike a chord in our worldview as well. So without further ado, the politically correct Christian churches of today would not think of condoning adultery. Yet they seem to have no problem with condoning miscegenation, which is, by definition, a form of adultery. I'll read the definitions of several words from the Internet Dictionary. Miscegenation is defined as follows. Marriage, or cohabitation between a man and woman of different races, especially in the U.S., between a white person and a black person. Interbreeding between members of different races, or the mixing or a mixture of races by interbreeding. Adultery is defined as voluntary sexual intercourse between a married person and someone other than his or her lawful spouse. The definition of adulterate is to debase or make impure by adding inferior materials or elements, use cheaper, inferior, or less desirable goods in the production of any professedly genuine article. To adulterate food, or in adjective form, adulterated or adulteress. Adulteress is defined as characterized by or involved in adultery, or illicit, an adulterous relationship. Based on these definitions, I can only conclude that since adulterous is defined with adulterate, and yet it is described as characterized by or involved in adultery, that adultery is the act of adulterating something, and the something that is being adulterated is your race, when you have sexual intercourse with someone who is not of your race. You will note that miscegenation is the mixing of races. And adulterating is debasing and making impure. It makes that which is produced inferior and less desirable. I would imagine most of us have interacted in one way or another with someone who is of mixed race. There are many variations today, but the one that seems to stand out the most are those who are of white-Negro mixture, commonly called mulatto in the past, although that term isn't heard very often anymore. Have you ever noticed how they seem to be improperly put together in subtle ways? As if their various pieces and parts know they don't belong together, and they're simply doing their best to get along and work together since they really don't have any choice in the matter? If you've never noticed this before, it's quite enlightening to spend some time watching a few, if you can. I'll admit it's not always easy to do since they really are often very ugly creatures. Don't look at those of mixed race in Hollywood, as they have the money to surgically alter their appearance to appear more cohesive than they actually are, with the hope that they will then also appear more attractive, thus enticing others to follow in their footsteps. Maybe choose someone you work with, or go sit in a mall somewhere and just people watch for a bit. After a while, it becomes apparent there's something wrong with how they're put together. It's subtle, and rarely something you can actually define with words. But for all its subtlety, it's not your imagination. There really is something wrong with them. It's oftentimes more obvious in the health problems they have, since it's known that interbreeding causes many mutations in the offspring, and they are often of a much weaker constitution than the parents. Getting back to the Christian perspective, the biblical commandment, "Thou shalt not commit adultery," is speaking as much about race mixing as about being faithful to your spouse. The Christian churches of today may be politically correct, but they violate the scriptures they claim to follow, most actively promote race mixing, since all are under the mantle of Christ, and they claim God sees no difference once a person is saved. It was not always so, however. Just 100 years ago, it would have been unthinkable in Christian churches of that time for the races to attend church together, let alone doing the things that are openly condoned today, namely the mixing of races. Going back further in time, Paul, being raised as a follower of the law, knew and understood the meaning of adultery very well when he encouraged the people of his time to not be unequally yoked. I know, once again, this is pretty basic, but words have meaning, and one of the ways Jews try to force their worldview on others is to slowly change the meanings of words over time. Adultery is a big one, It started out meaning miscegenation, and everyone understood that as its basic meaning. But over time, it evolved to mean something entirely different, although related. Being sexually unfaithful to one's husband or wife. When the meanings are related, yet not the same, the Jew wants to make sure you focus on the second, while forgetting the first. Since it would be really hard to create an amalgamated race if everyone understood the true meaning of adultery. Hail victory, comrades!
This is Trampled by Turtles. Back to the emails. Dear HAC, I really appreciate the comments and the sound bites that you played from the late, great Huey Long. The Kingfish has always been one of my favorite characters from the past. Can we please have some more commentary from you on the history of our movement, especially the parts you've been involved in? Signed, Jeff from Louisiana. Dear Jeff, well, for reasons which will be obvious if you think about it, I try to keep my comments on things in our movement's past that I have been personally involved in to a bare minimum, because there is still an immense amount of open and dirty baggage strewn across the floor from our past, especially the 1990s, when everyone seems to have gone a little insane. Well, more insane than usual for us, anyway. However, you're right, our movement does indeed have a past, a long and honorable one, as part of the American mainstream. And yet the overwhelming majority of people on the racial right in this country have no idea on earth where we came from, especially young skinhead types who are all tattoos and beer. They babble about heritage, and they have no idea on earth what their heritage really is. For example, how many of you people out there know what a populace was? I don't mean Carto's scam of a few years back. I mean the real populace from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. How about movements like the Grange and the IWW? And yes, I know the IWW was technically communist, but back over 100 years ago, as America was transforming into an industrial society, white supremacy, as it was then called, had a very leftist tinge to it. Now, another example. I bet very few of you know that us wicked, evil white nationalists and the hard, radical left actually share a literary hero from that period in common between the two of us. And I'm referring to the famous writer Jack London, who was a pre-Marxist populist of the old school, meaning that he supported white working people against buccaneer capitalists and also against black and Asian immigrant labor. And he was also a deeply convinced racist and Nordicist who predicted the coming extinction of the white race beneath the drowning waves of third world immigration. Now, if you don't believe me, you can read his famous novels Daughter of the Snows and The Iron Heel, and you'll see both aspects of London's belief system. Or else you can read his 1904 essay called The Yellow Peril about Chinese immigration, which is where the term yellow peril comes from, by the way, in case anybody's interested. There are a lot of names that you guys really should know from that period in our history. Names like William Jennings Bryan, Senator Theodore Bilbo from Mississippi, and Pitchfork Ben Tillman from South Carolina. Unfortunately, most of these great men passed on around the same time that sound recording was being invented. So I sent Gretchen a biography of one of the greatest of the populists of the last century, Senator Tom Watson of Georgia.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be speaking about the career of Tom Watson. Tom Watson was born on a southern middle-class plantation, and this plantation was a place of great peace and security for Tom. Tom Watson was descended from a line of Quakers that had moved to Georgia, but most of these Quakers, because of their abhorrence for slavery, had later moved on to the Northwest. However, the Watson family stayed in Georgia, and later on they became Baptists. Now, Tom's father, John Smith Watson, went off to fight in the Civil War. When he came back, he tried to recreate the antebellum South by building a mansion, but economically this did not work, and he drank and gambled and became very prone to depression. Eventually, Tom was forced to drop out of school for a time, but then he goes back to college. Eventually, Tom attempts to move to Augusta, but he really does not like city life. Tom ends up going to law school. He also tries his hand at teaching and eventually becomes involved in the Baptist temperance movement, probably as a rebellion against his father. Now, for a time during his youth, Tom becomes a bit of a playboy, and he also becomes very involved in music. He loves fiddling. But as he gets a bit older, he becomes more studious and more hardworking, and he buys his family some land in an attempt to recreate his childhood. Then he ends up getting married, and at this point, like many people that are in the law, he starts getting involved in politics, and he has a great gift for oratory. He also takes on a lot of cases as a defense lawyer, and he's really very successful in this. As a Southerner, he looks up to two of the Confederate heroes, Toombs and Stephen. He particularly loves Toombs because Toombs is very much unreconstructed and he has a lot of romance for the Old South, but he also realizes the need to be somewhat practical in politics. So, as a politician, Watson takes a somewhat different stance from a lot of the other Southerners who start getting very much involved in the railroads and start getting very involved in the Democratic Party, the New Departure, and the old Klan. For example, he contrasts with General Gordon, who is always looking for new ways to earn money, because it seems that Watson really sees the soul of the South as being agricultural. He starts up a farmer's alliance, and the Negro farmers also had a parallel alliance. Hans Alliance ends up staging its own conventions, and eventually this would become a third party. Now, Watson, he really tended to appeal to the Negro vote. He was for free schools, he opposed chain gangs, and even in one speech he courted Negroes by seeming to endorse the Republicans, and this was a time when everything was different in those days, and the Republicans were actually more the Negro Party than the Democrats. He is opposed to chain gangs because he sees it as commercialization of states' rights to punish criminals. More and more, he begins to go against the capitalists. He loves the South and he loves the agricultural tradition of the South, and that makes it very hard for him to embrace industry as Gordon had. He really becomes a populist because he can't really find any place for his views. He wants a union with the West, and this is fairly controversial at the time. C.C. Post ends up writing a book about him and his idea of having a third party. One of the things he champions against is the Pinkerton Detective Agency, which is really a gang that breaks up strikes. In those days, politics was really very much more of a brawl than it is today, and there were two instances of this gang going out to break up strikes. Once at the Homestead Carnegie Steel Plant and in Coeur d'Alene. Watson was also against war with Chile. He's always against military spending. And he becomes very impassioned, so much so that he's accused of drinking, which he takes great umbrage to, because at this point in his life, he doesn't seem to be drinking at all. Now, the author points out that there's this issue going on between democracy and plutocracy. Now, the populists, they were for democracy and against plutocracy. And they were an aspiring class. They were poor farmers, although some were landowners with lots of tenants, and some were just very poor. He takes this tact instead of becoming business-oriented, as so many did. And the thing about the South is that racial issues were always compounded by class, but again, he really is very pro-Negro at this point in his career, so much that one of his brothers even said that he was a traitor, and Patrick Welch said it was better to be poor than to go against the Democrats. Things got very rowdy because at this point in his career, Watson was really very, very pro-Negro, so much that he was really greatly upsetting Southerners. Things were becoming more and more violent, and there were all kinds of threats against Watson, threats against his friends. He takes on a free mail delivery for farmers. he wants to reject a plan to nationalize militias. Although he does not have any problem with Cleveland as an individual, but he sees him as a sworn enemy associating with Eastern capitalism. And he just sees the South as getting poorer and poorer. At this point, there's a depression. Watson turns to the novels of Bellamy and Durmarest and Lloyd's, and he wants to nationalize the railroads. He continues in that vein. Really, at this time, his view is so eclectic or so liberal, you might say, that he admires Emma Goldman, a Jewish anarchist. He probably very much dislikes this move by Cleveland to prevent a strike. At this point, Watson sees the need for his party to promote respectable candidates. He ends up endorsing James Hines. At this point, he becomes somewhat more conciliatory than usual in his speeches. He's always trying to find ways that people might be disenfranchised, and as people get more and more worried about his populist movement, there's more and more vote fraud, especially using the Negroes to perpetuate this vote fraud. At one point, General Weaver starts to want to fuse the populists and the Democrats, and he does not like this idea of fusing these parties. Although, I think that it does happen eventually, and you can see how some of this populist agenda becomes taken on by the Democrats over time. Throughout his career, he's always admiring different politicians. Theodore Roosevelt admired him, but Spanish-American War caused him to be very depressed because he's always against the military. I can understand this because of his Confederate background. He probably sees the military as kind of squashing the South. But strangely enough, he also admires Napoleon. And at one point, he writes about France and he writes about Napoleon. And it's kind of strange, but since he personally identifies with Napoleon, it makes some degree of sense. Now, suddenly, as he gets more frustrated, as he finds that a lot of his bids for various offices are thwarted, he decides he's going to sacrifice the enfranchisement of the Negro. And it's also possible that he loses his respect for Negroes. Perhaps he sees them as easily manipulated. And this break with the Negroes makes it difficult for the Northern progressives to continue to like him. Other thing that happens, that Fagan case, that's the case when a Jewish man is accused of killing an Irish-American factory worker by the name of Fagan. It is possible that this Fagan was actually murdered by a Negro. There's a lot of politicians that, I mean, not only in the Jewish community, as you might expect, but outside of it, that really think that this Jewish man is being falsely accused. But at this point in his life, Watson is getting, well, more and more emotional, and more he gets to see things from the point of view of what they then called white supremacy. He becomes very upset about this case. He starts becoming very anti-Jewish as well as very anti-Catholic. And he ends up getting involved in the new Klan, may have even restarting the Klan that had earlier disbanded. As World War I comes up, he becomes very anti-war. He's very anti-war in his publication, The Jeffersonian. And eventually, the Sedition and Espionage Act catches up with him, and he can no longer publish his paper. Some of his friends are arrested. But after the war, he ends up running for governor, and he promises to reinstate a lot of the freedoms that were lost during the war because of the conscription and because of all the sedition acts that had been going on, and he ends up getting elected as governor. At this point in his life, he's really having a tough time. Both his son and his daughter end up dying. It doesn't say of what, but it may have been of the very serious influenza at that time because they both seem to die rather suddenly. This really is rough on him. It's rough on his mental state, and it takes him a long time to recover. But he does end up becoming governor, and he continues to be very concerned about the poor, at least the poor whites. And in his 60s, he ends up dying of an asthma attack. So he has a very full life, a career in politics that is often kind of confusing, I have to admit, because he changes his mind so many things. So I hope you enjoyed this report, and thank you very much for listening. Harold sent me this book. It's a book called Tom Watson, Agrarian Rebel. So he obviously predates Huey Long. So I found this book interesting, although I have to say it was very long. It gets into his career very, very detailed, and I had a lot of notes that I really had to pare down. So I thank you for listening.
Now, I need to amplify somewhat on Gretchen's comments on the Mary Fagan murder case. To make a long and complex story as short as possible, Watson's main problem with the affair was not so much that Leo Frank was a Jew, but it was due to the fact that Jewish money was so clearly buying the Georgia state judicial process for the purpose of getting Frank's sentence commuted, after Frank raped and strangled a 13-year-old white girl who worked in the pencil factory he managed. The actual lynching of the Jew Leo Frank occurred after the outgoing governor of Georgia, a machine politician named Slayton, as his last act in office commuted Frank's death sentence, and then a short time afterwards, Slayton's political enemies and the press between them discovered $100,000, which had mysteriously appeared in Slayton's bank account from an unidentified source in New York. Now, Leo Frank's reprieve by the governor was pretty obviously bought with Jewish bribe money and would have been the prelude to his actual release as soon as Frank's legal team of 8 Jewish lawyers came up with quote-unquote new evidence. And there were people in Georgia who just said, no, we're not for sale to Jewish money down here. So Leo Frank was broken out of prison and strung up in Marietta on the Fagan family's doorstep, the house where Mary once lived. Yeah, believe it or not, there were once white men who would do things like that. Hard to imagine these days, isn't it? Anyway, there was some recording available in 1915, and someone wrote a popular song about the little white girl who was violated and murdered by a Jew who almost got away with it. This is Vernon Dalhart.
Fagan, she went to town one day. She went to the pencil factory to get a little pay. She left her home at 7. She kissed her mother goodbye. Not one time did the poor child think that she was going to die. Then a villain met her with a brutal heart, we know. He smiled and said to Mary, you'll go home no more. He sneaked along behind her till she reached the metal room. He laughed and said, little Mary, you've met your fatal doom. Was the watchman, and when he wound the key, away down in the basement, little Mary he could see. He called for the policeman, Their names I do not know. They came to the pencil factory and told Newt he must go. Her mother sits a-weeping. She weeps and moans all day. She prays to meet her baby in a better world someday. Judge Long passed the sentence. You bet he did not fail. Solicitor Hugh Dorsey, he sent the bruise to jail. Astonished at the question, the angels they did say, why he killed poor Mary upon one holiday. Now come all you good people, wherever you may be, supposing little Mary belonged to you or me.
This next email is from Hank in Kentucky, who, by the by, sent me that Trampled by Turtles bluegrass cut that I played a few minutes ago. Hey, HAC, I'm trying to wrap my mind around National Socialism. I've always been treading the waters, afraid to go straight in, but something has been drawing me to it. Yep, know what you mean, Hank. The way the truth and the light is, kind of hard to hide under a bushel sometimes. Do you have any particular books you'd recommend, ones that clarify the NS message without getting too bogged down in the historical events of World War II? Well, yes, Hank, as a matter of fact, I do. You need to read White Power and This Time the World by the late Commander George Lincoln Rockwell. You can find them on Alibris.com. That's Alibris.com. And I think you can even find them on Amazon.com now. Try to read the books in that order. White Power first. For those of you who still equate National Socialism with, well, that's communism, Hitler's a communist. Actually, no, he wasn't. National Socialism is a worldview for white people based on the ideas and concepts of the German racial nationalist philosopher and statesman Adolf Hitler. National Socialism was adapted to the political and racial conditions of the United States by the late U.S. Navy Commander George Lincoln Rockwell, whose books I just recommended to Hank. Now, owing to the tragic and unnecessary suffering which took place during the Second World War, and because certain powerful elements in our society to this day maintain an interest in obscuring and concealing the truth, 70 years after the war's end, massive misconceptions still exist in America today about what National Socialism was and is. The National Socialist body of belief is founded on three principles. First off, we believe in natural order. We believe that the universe is governed by natural laws. In order for man to be happy and successful, he must first learn what these laws are and then follow them. Now, we believe that man is a part of the natural world, and that he is in no way separate or distinct from it. Because of this, we believe that society should be structured in accordance with the laws of nature, and not in opposition to them, as is the case today. The second thing we believe in is racial idealism. Racial idealism is based on the love of one's own people. It means placing the interests and the welfare of the racial community to which you belong ahead of your own personal interests and desires. As racial idealists, we have no wish to harm, exploit, or persecute any other racial group, despite a persistent media propaganda campaign of abuse and deliberate falsification to the contrary. We are only interested in protecting our own people against extinction, a fate all too likely if nothing is done about the present conditions in America. Now, we believe that all men are not created equal. Just as every individual has his own strengths and weaknesses, so each race has certain qualities which make it different from other races. Now, we believe that the white or Aryan race has the right to maintain its own biological, cultural, and political independence and integrity, and that we have the right to control our own destiny. We also believe that the white race has the right to defend itself against all physical, economic, and spiritual assaults, no matter where they come from. Now, the third thing we're very big on is the upward development of the white race. We want to do more than just defend our race. We want to see it improve. Now, this can be done by encouraging a high birth rate among those sections of the white population which are the healthiest, strongest, and most intelligent. At the same time, our science should work to eliminate hereditary weaknesses and defects among our people. Our goal is that each new generation of white children will be better than the one before it. But that's for the future. Our time is up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.